Right, okay, anybody's not here then?
That's fine.
It was easier to write down who was here. Yeah, Les, you work away, yeah? Oh, sorry. We're all over the place here tonight, Les. So anyway, good job.
Okay.
You do the human rights, so I'm going to read this out first.
All right, okay.
So, we'd like to welcome everyone here today to the meeting, and I assume you can all hear me clearly, and if everybody allows these gentlemen to speak and the ladies to speak, they'll all be able to hear us back, all right? Members of the public should remain seated throughout the meeting and shouldn't speak. Everyone should ensure the mobile phones are either turned off or switched to silent, and the use of mobile phones for recording is not permitted. The proceedings of the meeting will be audio recorded except for the council is considering any exempt matters. The recording equipment is linked to the microphone system, so please ensure your microphone is switched on before speaking. Members are reminded that they are personally responsible for any comments they are making at the meeting. To remind councillors of their obligation under the council's code of conduct to declare any financial or significant non-financial interest which they have in any item of business before the meeting today. If you have such an interest, please either declare it now or immediately before the item itself, stating the item of business it relates to. Having declared an interest, members should leave the table for the duration of the discussion on that particular item and should not vote. I assume there's no conflicts of interest. So, it's open to you now, Les.
Thank you, Chair, and can I thank councillors for hosting us today. One of my colleagues, Alan McBride, at the end, has to rush away fairly quickly for another engagement on the Chinese New Year, but the rest of us are a captive audience. And what I intend to do very briefly is say something about the community engagement we've been involved in today and about the Commission, but I don't intend to speak for more than 5-10 minutes at the most, and then it's over to you, because part of the community engagement is to hear what's happening on the ground. We embark on these community engagements across Northern Ireland. We were in Derry and Strabane district recently. We've been to West Belfast, we've been to Macrofelt and Cookstown, we've been to Carrickfergus, and these are really useful for us in terms of getting a sense from you about what the local issues are that are human rights issues. Today we started at the PSNI in Newry. We met both senior management and separately police officers on the ground. We've had a session with community and voluntary organisations from a broad spectrum, from CABs to those working on both Daisy Hill and Down District Hospital campaigns, to those working on community supportive housing and mental health initiatives, etc. And this is the third part of the day to hear from you. I'll say something very quickly about what the Commission is and does. We're a creature of the Belfast Agreement. We have statutory functions and role under the Northern Ireland Act 1998. That includes advising both the Westminster government when it's an issue which is reserved, so immigration, tax, security, foreign affairs, etc., and the Northern Ireland Assembly and the Executive when it's a devolved matter, all the issues that the Assembly are dealing with. So we engage in discussion locally on issues of legislation, on policies and the human rights aspects of those. We also play a role on the international stage. The UK government has signed up to a number of international treaties. In the last 12 months, for example, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. We would have given evidence about the circumstances, about how much we feel that those covenants are being properly adhered to by the UK government. There's often a dance between the UK government will say, here's all the wonderful things that we're doing to meet all our international obligations, and a national human rights institution like the Human Rights Commission or an NGOs tend to say, well, that's all very well, but here are some of the things that you should be doing as well or instead. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child was also up recently in the periodic report, and the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. There are a number of conventions coming up this year, including the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Part of our role is to make sure that the UK is held to account for what it is doing and giving praise where it's due and not doing. So it's about brickbats as well as bouquets. We have a role to promote the awareness of human rights through education and training and research. We can take legal cases, and we have done, and have been high profile and quite contentious legal cases that we've been involved in, not just on the issue of access determinations in Northern Ireland, but we have been involved in issues, for example, on mental health and awaiting a judgment there. So our work is high profile, but often some of the other work is perhaps more unseen. We can undertake investigations, human rights investigations. We recently completed one on healthcare and emergency departments, and have now embarked on a piece of work with the Belfast Trust to look at what would a human rights-based approach look like in emergency departments, and a piece of work with the Northern Trust about what would a fully human rights compliant and deeper involvement in participation look like, to go beyond the kind of formulaic, here's a document, here's a couple of meetings, and then we look at what everybody has to say, and then we carry on as if nothing had happened from the start to the finish, about what would a more meaningful engagement about planning health and social care look like in practice. It's led by the Northern Trust, but we've been very involved in that. So those are two of the things that come out of that human rights inquiry. We're in the middle of a human rights inquiry investigation into traveller accommodation, and we hope to complete that by the end of August this year. We have a business and human rights forum that we lead, and that business and human rights forum has got involved in issues like seeing domestic violence in the work as a workplace issue as well as a domestic issue, about looking at forced labour and human trafficking. We're about to be involved in a partnership with the Department of Finance on procurement and looking at having human rights impact-based and assessments and policies within procurement, particularly for agency workers, which is an area where traditionally there have often been concerns about the treatment of workers. So what are those who are tendering doing in terms of making sure their human rights policies are compliant? We have a piece of work for research that we're undertaking at the moment on people who are going to court without any legal representation because they either can't get access to legal aid or can't afford a lawyer, particularly around family law and bankruptcy. So that's a bit of the spread of the work that we do. What we're interested to hear from you is, what are the rights-based issues that you're facing on a daily basis as local elected representatives? And then we'll try and talk to you a little bit more then about kind of response to that. So before I kind of hand over to all of you, any of my colleagues want to add anything? That I probably should say that finally, we've got three kind of strategic priorities. One is delivering human rights through excellent services to the public, and that's where we've been doing a lot of work around training about how complaints handling processes might be human rights compliant with the Northern Ireland Public Services Ombudsman, for example. Human rights and building the future in Northern Ireland, and that's about looking at and recognising we have to deal with the past in order to look to the future. So we have been involved in commenting on and analysing the Stormont House Agreement and Fresh Start Agreement. We recognise that international standards become very important in terms of that, and there's a recognition within the Commission, and it's a difficult issue for the Commission as it is out there in local communities and local politics, but you can't sweep the issues of the past under the carpet and pretend or hope they will go away. They have to be addressed. So there's a recognition of that within the Commission. And then finally, social and economic rights in the time of change. And that's about the kind of work we've been doing that I'd mentioned earlier around healthcare, etc. There's a recognition again within the Commission. Human rights embraces civil and political rights, the rights, if you like, that are the ones that tend to gain the headlines. But social and economic rights, the right to an adequate standard of living, the right to housing, the right to healthcare, are human rights issues, and they are part of the tapestry of international standards that the UK government has signed up to and said they will adhere to. So I think that's enough from me. And it's kind of over to you.
Okay, Dougan.
Well, before bringing the two issues, I want to bring to your attention, I just want to thank you for the enormous help your organisation has given to the Irish-speaking community in South Down over the last 7 or 8 years. I mean, first and foremost, I recall meeting in your offices on the 50th anniversary of Rosa Parks getting on the bus in Alabama. And basically, we had a situation where the South Eastern Education and Library Board were refusing to allow Gaelic-speaking schools to access the Yellow Bus Network. And your advice was instrumental in getting John McAllister, who was MLA at that stage, to bring a case to the race relations people in order to find that the South Eastern Education and Library Board had acted out of order in that respect. About 2 years or 3 years prior to that, I think your previous commissioner, was it Monica McWilliams?
Yes, previous one,
yeah. Along with the Children's Commissioner at the time, attempted to intervene with the Department of Education and basically argue the point that the Good Friday Agreement was not advisory only, but actually had legal force of law. Now, they attempted to persuade the officials of the Department of Education that this was the case, but the officials insisted that the Good Friday Agreement was advisory only. Now, as it turned out, you turned out to be correct, and it eventually went to the High Court, and the High Court found that the provisions for the Irish under the Good Friday Agreement actually had the force of law and were not advisory only. And that was enormously helpful, all the work that you took and the time that your personnel took to support us in that regard. And it's very instrumental in allowing larger numbers of people to attend school, both at primary level and at secondary school, which is a huge impediment here in the country area, where if you don't have transport to school. So just to thank you for that long-standing series of engagements you've had with us and the huge case files you've built up on this particular issue. But to the point that I would raise with you today is that we have a number of issues which are pressing on us, and they're not obviously human rights issues, but I think when you get down and you examine the detail, they do have human rights impacts. Say, for instance, in this area, for about 4 or 5 years, we've had a situation where the Southeastern Health Trust has defined our local hospital as having a clinical need in this area for a 24-hour accident and emergency unit. Now, the clinical need has not gone away, but the trust has said they're been unable to find the staff to man the hospital, despite the fact that the shortage of A&E doctors and nurses, indeed all forms of medical staff, has been known for some 35 years. And it is within the remit of Stormont to increase the intake of nurses at the two nursing colleges and indeed at the universities, and they never or haven't adequately done so. So we have a situation whereby our ambulance service is stretched and sometimes captured in the Greater Belfast area, because when our ambulance go up there, they're then subject to the Greater Belfast dispatching of the ambulance service, and yet we're left down here with a clinical need for a 24-hour accident and emergency service, but we don't have one. We have local doctors covering out of hours. So that would be the first issue I'll bring to your attention. The second issue I'd bring to your attention is in the whole area of climate change and the impact that's having both locally and internationally. Clearly, with a situation whereby the sea level rise per annum has now risen to an excess of 3.4 millimetres per annum, and given the fact that the Northern Irish government isn't even recognising that it's 2 millimetres yet, it's very significant given the fact that we have 150 miles of a coastline in this area, and most of our settlements would be in difficulty in that regard. We have a situation whereby one of the two main parties in government is refusing to recognise climate change, and indeed many of their prominent members openly denying it within the media. This is a very significant problem in getting our local communities here geared up to deal with the issue of climate change if we have a party in power that denies the existence of climate change and therefore the impact that it's likely to have on the dozens of communities we have all around our coast from Strangford to Carlingford Lough. So there are two areas I would bring to your attention for future examination.
Would you like to?
Yeah, what I was going to suggest, if we'll take two or three contributions at a time rather than just...
Okay, Willie?
All right, thanks. And you're very welcome. Just in regards to the couple of points I would like to make is in regards to, you mentioned mental health, and particularly mental health and people end up in the judiciary system. In my opinion, it's a chronic problem. People end up in PSNI custody suites, and the majority of them would have mental health issues, and instead of getting treatment for either addictions or their mental health, they end up getting charged and then end up in the prison system, and particularly young people with lots of social problems. So just your thoughts in regards to that. The other point is social housing. There's a large numbers of people presenting, as you're probably aware of, homeless right across the north. In our area, the chronic areas would be Newcastle, Newry, and Warren Point. And you have the situation where people are languishing, for years on a waiting list. And again, with people with mental health issues, again with addiction problems, and who are staying with relatives on their settee, as I say, for years. And this is obviously having a detrimental impact on their health overall. And I would say it would be linked to suicide also. In many cases, I would be aware of a number of cases where it was just too much for the person. So in regards to dealing with the right to the person to have a home, the selection process in regards to social housing, if people are get intimidation points in Belfast or whatever, they end up then going top of the list. So the people living in the locality never get to the top of the list. They continually are about the middle of the slide or the priority list. So it's a fundamental issue that needs to be dealt with. I think the Minister for Community, I think they were carrying out some sort of review in regards to the selection process. But just again, your thoughts on that. And again, suicide and mental health and young people. Again, the Minister of Health was, carrying out a study in regards to that as well. But just your thoughts on that.
Thank you.
Declan?
Yeah, thank you. A couple of questions, really. One is that I know on many occasions people actually go up the wrong avenue in terms of their human rights. I'd be interested to hear your comments on that, where that crossover point is. Some people demand, obviously everything is a human right, which actually probably end up wasting a lot of time in your perspective. But the other item I had really was, would you believe that there's a danger of an erosion of human rights as we depart the EU? And will that the potential Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, will that potentially set that back as well, as we still haven't agreed it up?
And Charlotte.
Thanks, Chair. Just further, thank you to the members for turning out tonight. Just further to Declan's point, Chairperson, the impending catastrophe that is Brexit, panel, we are probably the region that is the least prepared, yet the most affected of this part of the world. And I don't think people actually realise the significance of the storm that we're heading into. But a specific question I would like an opinion on is obviously the British government have taken the view that the primary concern and consideration in their negotiations with the EU will be the control of immigration, and everything else will play a second fiddle to that. So I would like the view of the panel on a post-Brexit situation and the status of the indigenous population of the six counties who would carry Irish passports. That number is probably in the hundreds of thousands. Technically, will they have the same status as somebody from Romania in this part of the country, or do you have an alternative view? Thank you.
Okay, so Ned's going to come in now and then come back.
Okay, I'll try to pick up on all of those, and then I'll ask colleagues to chip in. On the language issues, the Commission continues to comment on, for example, there's a framework convention on minority languages, so the issue of the treatment of Irish language and Ulster Scots, for that matter, is something that is an issue that we'll comment on. Down the hospital is an issue that came up, not surprising, in our NGO meeting. When we held the human rights inquiry, we had meetings in both, public meetings in both Downpatrick and in Newry, and it was a very lively engagement. Human rights doesn't bring an answer to how you configure healthcare services, but human rights does say there is a right to the highest attainable standard of healthcare, and there is a concept of non-retrogression. In other words, that doesn't mean that everybody should have all their health needs met in specious 5 minutes flat, no matter what the circumstances, but what it does mean is that you are looking to attain that right to the highest attainable standard of health, that's both mental health and physical health, and it's a recognition that you're on a journey to get to, it's a progressive realization of that right, and that journey should continue to be heading in the right direction. So the concept of non-retrogression is that you shouldn't ever move backwards in doing that. And if you have to move backwards, and there are kind of human rights treaty monitoring bodies' comments on this, there's an onus on you to very clearly explain why and what the circumstances are. What our healthcare inquiry found, amongst other things, was actually we did a kind of economic analysis of expenditure on health, and the expenditure is going in the right direction. And what I mean by that is more money was being spent year on year in terms of healthcare. But when you looked behind that, what was quite clear was there's a core amount that's spent on health each year, and then there's kind of in-year monies. And it was the in-year monies which is where the extra money, if you like, was coming from in healthcare. And it was quite clear that in-year monies is very difficult to spend in a very long-term planned way. So you can throw money at a particular crisis to try and deal with whatever that issue immediately is, get down to lists, or but it's not a planned long-term solution. And the second thing we found very clearly was that the wraparound services had an impact on accidents and emergencies. So it relies on out-of-hours doctor services, minor injury units, social care, all being all working effectively, because then you can more efficiently control who comes into emergency departments, and you can more effectively then discharge people instead of sometimes in hospital back into the community. And none of that was working as effectively as it should have been. And the other thing we discovered was there's lots of good practice across Northern Ireland, but very little of it is shared out. So we found lots of different places, including in Down and in Daisy Hill, where good things are happening. And when you look at the structures and what they should be doing in theory, all that good practice should be rolled out, but it wasn't. And therefore, what looks like on paper a very good kind of consultative local, you know, commissioning model, local commissioning groups, it all looked very participative. But when you actually interrogate it in detail, it clearly wasn't. And I suspect that's where some of the issues you're having in terms of an engagement with not just the South East Trust, but the Health and Social Care Board, and ultimately the Department of Health. That's a long-winded way of saying there is not a one bound, you're free answer to this in terms of human rights. But one of the things we hope to do in the pilot is to look at a much more meaningful engagement with, in this case, the Northern Trust, about how you plan services. So that actually, and that means the trust having to not just listen to what's being said locally, but to take it into account. It doesn't mean that the Northern Trust has to do everything that everybody in its area tells it to do, but it has to very meaningfully engage. And if it decides not to do something, it has to very meaningfully engage in explaining why it's doing X and not Y, etc. So there might be some, I hope, useful learning for the South Eastern Trust and others, because that's a pilot that we would hope will give some important kind of feedback to the department. Climate change is not an issue, I'm afraid, we're dealing with. It's a reflection of the limited resources that we have, although I chair the Commonwealth Forum of National Human Rights Institutions, and one of the areas that we've looked at on the global stage is climate change. It's actually the Scottish Commission is one of the commissions involved, and I think it's Cameroon who are looking at. So while we have some involvement there, it's not been an issue on our radar, but I recognise that it's one of the kind of touchstone issues of our day. Questions about mental health and housing. Well, one of the great ironies is that we're about to meet as a commission to have a look at doing, probably now, certainly into the next financial year and beyond, but another human rights inquiry at some point. And the intention is to look at one of two areas. And, well, you've pretty much outlined the two areas that we're looking at. One is mental health, suicide and self-harm. The other is housing need and homelessness, particularly possibly with a focus on young people. Now, we can only do one of those at most. We'll have to bring some money in to do it. So personally, I'm very keen, though, to find a way, if we do a human rights inquiry, to move beyond. I mean, I could pretty much write some of the conclusions already, which is you need more money to go into child adolescent mental health services, for example. You need more money to go into social housing and other housing. I'm sure we would find lots of other things, but some of the answers, not everything, is about spending more money on either housing or mental health. Now, in the current climate, there doesn't seem much likelihood of a lot more money being available. So then you end up in the unenviable position of saying, well, if you put more money into mental health, where's it coming from? Well, it might come at the expense of housing or education or wherever. So I'm very keen, and there's a burgeoning international kind of human rights work around the issue of taxation, more progressive taxation systems, corporations paying their taxes effectively and dealing with issues of tax avoidance. Now, given our structures locally, we don't have tax-raising powers, but we're moving into an era through Scotland where they're looking at those issues. And I think we have to recognise that if we want better public services, we've got to look at how we pay for them. That's a much more longer-term issue, so we'll try on one of those issues in the next 2 or 3 years, focus on either mental health, suicide and self-harm, or housing need and homelessness. How we reach, there's a compelling argument to do both. We don't have the resources to do both. But those issues are on our radar. Brexit. I will be involved in the Endicenny initiative, which is looking at the impact of the UK leaving the European Union. What does that mean across the island of Ireland? There will be a session on human rights and equality in the next couple of weeks. The Commission will be involved in that. There is a thread of, by leaving the European Union, for example, that almost certainly means the UK government, and pretty much said it in Parliament last week, they will want to look at leaving the Fundamental Charter of Rights, which is part of something you signed up to through the Lisbon Treaty. Now, if that is a kind of convention plus approach, European Convention plus approach to human rights, which of course is what the Belfast Agreement envisaged as well, was the idea of convention rights, but the Bill of Rights was designed to be a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, which was about rights supplementary to the European Convention on Human Rights, taking into account the circumstances of Northern Ireland, and the Human Rights Act, which has been up for grabs for some time, and again, it's pretty clear that any change to the Human Rights Act has been kicked into touch until at least we see what's happening to Brexit. So there is a thread that leads right back to the Belfast Agreement and the approaches to the Belfast Agreement. We don't know what the UK's negotiating stance will be. I read Theresa May's speech. I read the Irish government's response to it. I'm still not that much the wiser, despite kind of her speech, other than recognising you can't be half in and half out of the European Union. The issue of the common travel area, which is the one that will determine some of the issues about whether Irish citizens will have a slightly different set of rights, if you like, to those from Romania or Hungary or Germany or France. It's clear that both governments have said that they wish to retain the common travel area. They make great play of the fact that it preceded the UK joining the EU. It will be a matter for the 27 member states, as well as it's quite clear that the Irish government and the UK government want to maintain the common travel area. There will be some difficulties in the sense of, if you want to have a much more closed border approach, it's difficult to have one approach, if you like, in Calais and Dover and elsewhere, and a very different approach to coming in from Dublin through to Belfast, etc. So we are going to have to wait and see what happens. One of the things the Commission did was it did a scoping piece of work around, well, what are universities doing in terms of looking at the implications of this? And what we discovered is pretty much the same set of situations that applied to the UK government. When Scotland was looking for independence, the UK government published a 600-page document about what the implications of Scottish independence would mean. They didn't publish anything about what leaving the European Union would mean, and it wasn't that they had the 600-page document sitting under their desks ready for day one. They had made no preparation of any significance at all, and universities were in exactly the same position. So there's some interesting stuff now done through the European Union Lords Committee. Scotland has now done some work about kind of the human rights, but it's all at a very early stage. And until we really know, not just actually what the UK's stance will be on human rights and other issues, and just as importantly, what the EU member states, 27 member states, attitude will be, we're going to have to kind of watch the space. So we can set out the implications of things, but the fine detail comment is going to have to wait and see what kind of arrangement emerges from the negotiations. I think I've probably hopefully covered kind of things in there, but again, if I ask any colleagues if they want to add anything.
I suppose the only thing I would add in relation to the mental health needs of prisoners, I do think there are also physical health and social care needs, and we have been looking at doing some work with that, and we're looking at to see what other agencies are doing, but there is a much wider issue than mental health in relation to those within the prison system. In relation to Davey's point about South Eastern Trust and the Down Hospital, I think the outgoing health minister has made it clear that all political parties are going to have to come together to look at how our hospital structures work in the future, and the latest report has significant implications for the whole structure of healthcare in Northern Ireland, and I think that's something we'll have to see how all of the political parties come together to take that work forward.
Just to follow up from what Marion was saying about the health challenges, I think none of us should be in any doubt at all that health is now and in coming years will be one of the most difficult challenges facing us as a society, especially in Northern Ireland, because we have a disproportionate number of ageing people as well as a disproportionate number of young people, and that means those are the two biggest users of health services, and our system is very ill-equipped indeed to cope with that demographic challenge, as well as being very ill-equipped to deal with the pace of change in terms of the technologies that are available, the drugs that are available. And I'm afraid I don't see that the discussion at the moment is anywhere near actually tackling the difficulties of those issues. I think we all need to try and get our heads around it. And, you know, okay, up the number of doctors we train, but the fact is that an awful lot of the doctors we train, no sooner as they trained, then they're on the plane and going to Australia or New Zealand or America, where they can earn far more in far better surroundings than they can here. And the same goes for nurses. So, you know, there is a real challenge there, and I think it's down to us as a community to actually start reading into it, looking at it, thinking about it, and trying to come up with a solution that works for us here. Because we're not England, we're not Scotland, though we're more like Scotland. And we've got to tackle that. But it's going to need us collectively to apply our minds to it and not just sort of point at the people in Stormont or in Linen Hall Street and say, you fix it, because actually they can't fix it. And I think they're beginning to realise that. So just sort of put that down as being a real challenge that we do need to tackle, and it's not going to be easy.
There's one question I think I didn't answer, which is Declan's, your one about misperception of human rights. And I take a fairly rose-tinted optimistic view of where we've got to with the discussion about rights. I remember I've been working in the voluntary sector for more than 30 years before I became Human Rights Commission commissioner, and I remember debates about rights used to be almost in a cloistered world of academics and lawyers and a few others. Now, rights-based discussions are much wider discussed. People assert their rights, and I think that broadly is a good thing. I don't always recognise the rights and the when people assert it's my right to do X or Y. I don't always recognise the human right that actually is behind some of that assertion of rights. But I think a rights-based discussion and discourse is broadly a good thing. What I would say is part of our role is to try and make sure that people understand that rights discussions in human rights terms are based on international standards. They're universal. They've been signed up to in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child by every single country in the world, bar the US, I think. But the UK has signed up to, the Irish government has signed up to a very large number of treaties on human rights. So there is a strong body. It comes then with regional and the European Convention and then the Human Rights Act, etc. So part of our role is to recognise that. I don't have any difficulty with the concept of that there are absolute rights and qualified rights, and rights bring with them responsibilities. The issue for me is, as long as that debate about responsibilities isn't used to stifle the rights in the first place, rights and responsibilities and that idea of rights and duties is something that I'm, and the Commission I think is comfortable with. And some of the work that we've done has been through film, through use of social media, through Instagram, etc. We've produced this relatively recently a set of films about what we call hidden rights, so looking at migrant workers, looking at victims of domestic violence, looking at issues of very positive examples of people with disabilities who have overcome those disabilities in a kind of very strong role model way, and on housing and young people, and the issue of homelessness is not just about street homeless, that many of the people you wouldn't notice on a day-to-day basis or any different from you or I are homeless as well. So we try and make sure that people understand where human rights comes from in the first place as a kind of educative role, but having those debates in general is worth doing, and it's part of our role to try and correct the misperceptions, but at least if people are thinking in rights-based terms, that's the first base starting point in which we can engage with people. So I hope that's kind of a bit of an answer to that question. I'm sorry I didn't pick it up earlier.
Okay. Terry?
Thank you very much, Chair. First of all, to the Commission, you're very welcome. I've have enjoyed your contributions to tonight's debate, but I think we left you guys looking at something from a completely different angle on a topic that hasn't really been covered. And I think, for example, if you take till marital status, an example, in Northern Ireland, well, you have the sanctity of marriage, you have civil partnerships and all, but in a case you take, example, a couple who have lived together for many years, say, as partners, as man and wife, and, for example, one of them doesn't leave a will, and the next thing that happens is an illegal situation that exists over here, that person's family can step in and take over the whole lot of that person's estate, leaving the poor person that lived with this partner or loved one for many years out in the cold and out in the rear. You know, and I'd like to ask the Human Rights Commission, exactly why can't the principle of common law not be extended to Northern Ireland as it exists in mainland Britain, which gives couples who live together, I think it's a minimum of 7 years, the same rights as a married couple. And I think over here we are living in the dark ages, because I've heard of cases that, for example, people have lived together for 40, 50 years, person doesn't leave a will, and then they're the person that lived with that, with their partner, ended up. It's not a case of materialism or whatever or anything, but the fact is, I think the system is unjust over here, that common law does not exist for common law for people that live together.
Would you like to answer that one, Mary?
Well, do you want to take a couple and I'll,
okay.
Again, I'll come back?
Oh, could you open the back yet again? Yeah.
Sorry, Chairperson, I wasn't aware that the Commission was involved in the Brexit issue, so I just, by way of a point, are you aware that Liechtenstein is in monetary and political union with Switzerland, yet is part of the single market? This is something that the UK government has denied is possible on a regular basis apropos of Northern Ireland and indeed Scotland. Perhaps more relevantly, are you aware that the Channel Islands is not only using the pound sterling, but has a common travel area with the rest of the UK, but has a separate treaty with the European Union, and therefore when the Brexit vote took place, it did not take place in the Channel Islands, because they will continue under their existing treaty to have full membership of the European Community. This is again something that the British government has disavowed as being possible for Northern Ireland. So if you are involved in this particular case, it is possible that you would point to both the Liechtenstein example in terms of being a member of the single market whilst not being politically part of the European setup, or indeed the Channel Islands, where they're going to continue on with their own separate treaty with the European Community whilst remaining a full member of the United Kingdom and with their use of the UK pound with a common travel area, etc., within the UK. Thank you.
Take a couple more now.
Pete.
Yeah, I'm just following on from the point that Terry was talking about. This is actually based on your annual statement that I believe was out, was it December, at the end of last year, and how you mark the urgency of some of the issues. And in particular, an issue that affects me as I'm in a civil partnership is the extension of the civil marriage to same-sex couples. And I see on the traffic light system that you have it marked as amber. Now, to me, that's disappointing, because I believe that it should be a red issue, which would recognise that the issue is an ongoing violation of human rights within NI. So I want to ask why this issue is marked as amber, because that would lead that the issue may not be at a level that constitutes an ongoing violation, or that you believe, as the Human Rights Commission, that you feel that adequate steps have been taken to an effective response by the Assembly, or is it because of the High Court challenge? So I want clarity around why it's not a red issue.
Charlie?
Well, thanks, Chair. I'd just like the group's view on the rights or not of political ex-prisoners. As one myself, and my release date was something like 40 years ago, but even to this day, there are certain restrictions on political ex-prisoners. They travel. For instance, I couldn't adopt children if I wanted to. I couldn't be a bus driver or a taxi driver. I couldn't get a part-time job in the Royal Mail delivering letters. Yet, I mean, I could be Justice Minister for the party if they decided that that's the role for me in the future. And even this week, a guy I know from Armagh, he was refused travel to Cuba because the airplane that he was traveling in would fly to US airspace. So he was refused permission to travel because of that. So there are a serious amount of restrictions on political ex-prisoners. I don't know, I thought there was something enshrined in the Good Friday Agreement that, you know, we have rights and we all have rights. I mean, I would never have been inside prison or prison camp, but for any other reason, only I found myself involved in a conflict as it progressed from the early, late 60s, early 70s. So, do you have a view on that?
Okay, that's a pretty broad-based set of issues. If I, again, try to pick them up, and if I miss anything, feel free to come back to me. The first one was the issue of common law partnerships. And I'll pick that up and the civil partnership issue. I'm not sure in terms of wills that we're actually that far behind England, Scotland and Wales. And the depressing point is that I don't know that in terms of common law relationships and the implications of being in a common law relationship as opposed to a civil partnership. So I'm talking here about heterosexual couples. If you don't get married, the level of rights you have if the relationship breaks up are very limited indeed compared to being married. So there are actually some protections about being married as opposed to being in a common law relationship. There's been a Law Commission report in England and Wales which recommended wholesale changes to the law that recognised common law relationships, that once they had been, a couple had been together for a period of time, that would enshrine some protections. But England, Scotland and Wales have made no more progress on that, as far as I understand, than we have in Northern Ireland. So, yes, that's something that would make immense policy sense in terms of protection, but I don't think it's happening anywhere else. Interestingly, a case in which, not a case the Commission's been involved in, but an interesting case that Citizens Advice have taken through their regional office in Belfast, has been about the right to the equivalent of bereavement benefits, which currently are only paid to, again, those who are married, not extended to common law relationships. A case of somebody who'd been in a common law relationship for 23 years, her partner died, and she couldn't access bereavement benefits, and they're now seeking leave to go to the Supreme Court. So on some occasions, Northern Ireland can be ahead of the game in terms of asserting rights. In terms of why the failure to extend civil partnerships into access to gay marriage in Northern Ireland, which is now something that people have in both England, Scotland, Wales, and in Ireland, the reason it's amber is that, and I hope we're wrong, but our view is we're not convinced that there is a straightforward, you must have gay marriage on a human rights basis. In other words, that if a government extends a civil partnership and doesn't extend that to gay marriage, that is wrong in law in terms of conventions, etc. Round the table of the Commission, we would be delighted to see the High Court challenges, and there are two sets of challenges. We've followed it very closely. One is what I'll call a full kind of frontal challenge, which says the lack of access to gay marriage in itself is contrary to human rights. And the other is a more nuanced challenge, which is joined with it, which is that the family rights that go with being married elsewhere in the UK as compared to a civil partnership and a gay couple who were married in England coming back to Northern Ireland and losing some of their family rights. And that's that kind of incremental challenge. I suspect that one has more chance of success, but it's a recognition not of a lack of support for gay marriage within the Commission, but a technical recognition that we're not sure that it is a violation of human rights where there is civil partnerships with the protections that are there. But we would be delighted to be proved wrong in terms of if the High Court decided that you had to, by law, extend gay marriage to Northern Ireland. So we would be supportive of that. But that's the basis on which it has an amber light rather than a red light in our report. It's not a reflection that we don't think that, in equality terms, that the right of gay marriage here as is the case across these islands, wouldn't be a good thing. In terms of Liechtenstein and the Channel Islands, all I can say, I know what the common travel area is, but I don't profess to be on top of what's going on in either Liechtenstein or the Channel Islands. I think the Channel Islands is a Crown dependency. It's not part of the UK, but it is part of the common travel area. I'll go away and look, but it's not something I have to say that I've spent a lot of time looking at, but it's kind of interesting now. And Liechtenstein is not a place that I've spent much time, I have to say, thinking about, unless they're playing either parts of Ireland in a football match. I can't. So I'll go away and take that away. Yeah. But I mean, the fact that it's an interesting point. And then finally, the issue of ex-prisoners. It is an issue that we've been involved in terms of the question of there was a working group previously which the Commission was on about looking at ex-prisoners. This is the issue of reintegration. There are a plethora of issues that we're aware of. Access to insurance, you meant about adoption, freedom to travel, and we recognise that those issues are not issues that just affect those who serve prison sentences, but often the family members another generation down are affected by it as well. It's an issue that international standards have looked at as part of demobilisation, disarmament and reintegration, which we're aware of. We don't have, again, a one-bound free solution to how you deal with those, but it's an issue that comes up again and again. So, and it is an issue that we've made representations on, and as part of our Commonwealth National, I'm the chair of the Commonwealth National Human Rights Forum, it's an issue that's come up there. So it's not an issue that's confined just to Northern Ireland in terms of countries. But I hope I've kind of picked anything up, but again, I'll ask my colleagues if they want to add anything.
Just a couple of things on the ex-prisoner rights point. As far as work's concerned, you know, I think document anything that you're not allowed to do or any of yours aren't allowed to do, and take it up, follow it up, because there isn't really a reason. You know, there are only a very few jobs where there is a need for somebody to be excluded from them. And it's the grounds of safety, and that's understandable. But document it and raise it, because that's the only way of stopping people doing things that they shouldn't. On travel, I think it's complicated because we can do what we like at this end, but what the Americans do is their business, and I have to say I think they have some of the toughest rules around who is allowed into America, even before the latest thing that there are around, because I think even if you've got a conviction for failing to file your company accounts, you won't get into the States to go to visit Disney World. So they are incredibly tough about any sort of criminal record at all. That's just the way they are. And I don't know that there's very much we can do about that, because that's just their rules. But if that's helpful, I hope so.
Okay. Any other questions, folks?
Can I just add one thing just on the extra? We did feed into Pete Sherlow, who chairs the report, about looking specifically the issue of employment and ex-prisoners. And I think we provided some useful background material about what the both the human rights standards are, but also some of the court cases around that, which I think have been used by. So we have had an input, particularly into the issue of employment and ex-prisoners, which is one thing we've had some direct work on, to try and find a way through the existing kind of issues and looked at kind of some of the case law on the international stage, because the case law domestically is not particularly helpful to the idea of getting people who have been in prison back into work, whereas on the international stage, some of that kind of court cases has been more, if you like, user-friendly towards the idea of ex-prisoners and reintegration through employment.
Billy.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to know what you are doing or what way you're working with victims of terrorism over the years. You know, we see out there where a lot of people are trying to rewrite history. We had a motion in this council a couple of weeks ago, and it was allowed to proceed because we were told it was under their human rights. It was to free a suspected terrorist, let him out in bail, and that. So what way are you working with the victims of terrorism?
Do you want to take again a couple more?
There's no more.
Sorry. Yep. It's unfortunate that Alan had to leave early because one of our commissioners is Alan McBride, who works for WAVE, who himself was a victim of the Troubles in terms of losing his wife in a bomb campaign and has been an indefatigable campaigner for victims' rights within within the Commission. The Commission recognises that victims are do have rights. There's a recognition that the legislation as it stands in Northern Ireland, contentious though it is within the victim sector, makes it clear that there is not a hierarchy of victims, that all victims, regardless of their circumstances, should receive services and support, and therefore have a set of rights. And therefore, we've addressed that on a number of occasions, including in kind of our analysis of the Stormont House Agreement, for example, the Fresh Start Agreement. We've recognised issues around the mental health and mental well-being, as well as the physical well-being of victims. I meet regularly with the Victims and Survivors Commission. We've had an input into, and again through Alan, the idea of a pension for victims and survivors. I've addressed the annual WAVES annual kind of conference around victims, etc. So we are engaged in the issue. There's a recognition that human rights and victims have a set of human rights, and there are a set of issues that need to be addressed properly through international human rights standards. Again, I may ask colleagues if they want to kind of comment on some of the other work we're doing.
There's two things that the Commission has been engaged in for quite a number of years. One was Commission was involved as an intervener in the case that went to Strasbourg that laid down the right to life investigatory processes that are required by public authorities in terms of right to life cases. And we're currently just completing a piece on Article 3, which is around inhuman and degrading treatment for living victims and survivors of the conflict and the obligations of the state, not just in terms of providing remedy as to truth recovery for them and justice, but also access to services, health services, clinical support measures, those sorts of things. And that will be finished probably before the end of this current financial year.
I suppose the only thing I would add is that within our health and social care system, any victim, regardless of the cause or how they were injured or how they were traumatised, is eligible for treatment at no cost at the point of delivery according to their need. And I think we need to be very thankful that our medical, nursing and social care staff have all treated all victims with dignity and respect, regardless of how they acquired their injuries.
Okay.
So one other very quick final event, which is I'd forgotten to mention that I'd said earlier we'd talked to and gave evidence to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and Young People. So we've raised on the international stage, not just there but elsewhere, the issue of victims of paramilitary violence, so the issue of punishment beatings, punishment shootings, and that's a long-standing issue that we've raised on the international stage, again, as an issue of a violation of human rights. So we haven't just focused always on the state, although we often have around the right to life and Article 2 issues. The Article 3 issues and the issues of paramilitary violence is something that we've raised both locally and internationally. So just to kind of mention that as well.
Roisin?
Thanks, Chair. Last week we actually had a workshop with the Good Relations, Community Relations departments, and we were given facts and figures at that workshop where we were talking about foreign nationals that are, you know, have come here to work, and if they go to get their visas renewed to allow them to stay on, that they have to prove that they have an income of £36,000. Now, I think for most of us that attended that workshop, we were quite shocked that that was the case, because a lot of these people, I mean, I think they quoted that there was one hospital in the north somewhere where up to 40% of the nursing staff in different departments were from the Philippines and what have you. Now, none of those people would be earning £36,000. And between nurses, hospitality staff, agricultural workers, none of them would be earning that salary. Have you any sort of thoughts on what you can do to assure that those people are actually looked at in a fair and more appropriate manner? Because I would say the vast majority of people living in the six counties do not earn anywhere near than that, close to that. Now, this has obviously been something that has been dreamed up in London, where the incomes are very high, and somebody has just sat at a calculator and dreamed this number up. But really, we're all a bit worried when we look and see what's happening with both Brexit and the likes of Donald Trump. You know, the reality of it is our hospitality industry, our hospitals, our agriculture would all be in a very serious state if these people were actually told, you're not earning enough money, you have to go home. But that potentially could happen. Have you any thoughts, or can you do anything on that, any information?
I can give you a bit of information. I mean, the two issues that I know income is around, I think this is probably, the UK has a migration, it's got a migrant advisory committee, and there is legislation around two things. One is the level of income. This is for people outside of the European Union, so these income thresholds are for people coming outside of the European Union. One of them is about your income in order to be able to get a particular job to come in. The other is about an income that you have to have in order for your family members to join you. The latter is subject of a legal challenge, which is actually, they're awaiting a judgment at the Supreme Court at the moment about, one of the issues, of course, is the that level of income. Northern Ireland's average wage is significantly lower than other parts of the UK. So there is a legal challenge to whether that income threshold is reasonable, given that then those who want their family members to join them have to have a certain level of income guaranteed. I'm surprised it's 36,000. I thought it was slightly lower than that, but it was still enough to preclude a large number of people, like people from the Philippines working in social care, for example. So it's not an issue that we've been directly involved in. I have some knowledge of it because I used to be on a thing called the Strategic Migration Partnership before I joined the Commission, and I know it was an issue for both local employers as well as local councils. So it's probably worth feeding into through NILGA, to the Strategic Migration Partnership, because that is an issue where you might get some traction with them, because they were very exercised on it when I was on the SNP.
Yep.
Sorry, oh yeah.
And, you know, hopefully within the last Charlie, you left yourself open for that one. No, you're looking after everyone, Charlie.
Yeah.
Okay, is that it? Yeah. I want to say thank you very much to the Commission for coming. Appreciate you coming here.
Can I say thank you? We'll take all that away. It's really useful to get such a kind of broad level of feedback. And it's probably important to let you know as well that you've clearly a very number of effective NGOs in your area. And one of the things that will be another big takeaway for us is the importance of recognising the issue of rurality or rural areas, and the impact that some things have in Belfast is very different to the impact that the same thing happens in rural areas. And healthcare was just one of the issues that came up. So we're very cognizant of the kind of feedback we've got today, not just from yourselves, but also from the NGOs in the area. So all I can say is it's tough being a local elected representative at the best of times. So good luck with all your work.
We appreciate that. Everybody doesn't. Listen, everybody, good night, safe home, and keep canvassing. Good night.